Naram Chaiva Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jai Hudire. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our very means of conquest, we should offer our respectful obeisances unto Lord Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, unto Nar Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author, and unto Srila Prabhupada, the translator, commentator, and spiritual master, and in this case, the inspirer of the devotees who worked on this part of Bhagavatam. Nashta prayesha badreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavatyuttama Shloke Bhaktim Bhavati Naishtiki. By regular attendance in classes on Srimad Bhagavatam and by rendering devotional service to the pure devotee, all that is inauspicious within the heart is destroyed almost to nil, and loving devotion to the Supreme Lord is glorified in transcendental songs. Is established as an irrevocable fact. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. On this 22nd day of April 2014 in Alachua, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, the Summum Bonum, chapter 40, the prayers of Akura, text number 8 and 9. So we'll begin with the word-by-word meanings. Tvam, you, Eva, also, Anye, others, Shiva, by Lord Shiva, Uktena, spoken. Margena, by the path. Shivarupinam, in the form of Lord Shiva. Bahu Acharya, of many teachers. Vibhedena, following the different presentations. Bhagavantam, the Supreme Lord. Upasate, they worship. Tvame vanyeshi voktena, margena shivarupinam, bhav acharya vibhedena, bhagavantam upasate, tvame vanyeshi voktena, Margena Shivarupinam Vamacharya Vibhedena Bhagavantam Upasate Dvame Vanye Shivoktena Margena Shivarupinam Vamacharya Vibhedena Bhagavantam upasate. Tvame vanye shivoktena. Margena shivarupinam. Vame vanye shivoktena Kena shivarupinam Bhavacharya vibhedena Bhagavantam upasate. Ladies? Vame vanye shivoktena Magena Shivarupinam Bhavacharya Vibhedena Bhagavantam Upasate. Vame vanye shivoktena. Magena shivarupinam. Vavachaya vibhedena. Bhagavantam upasate. Translation. There are still others who worship you, the Supreme Lord, in the form of Lord Shiva. They follow the path described by him and interpreted in various ways by many teachers. Purport. The words Tvam Eva, you also, indicate that the path of worshiping Lord Shiva is indirect and therefore inferior. Akura himself is following the superior method by directly worshiping Krishna or Vishnu with his prayers. Next text. Savahevi Ajanti Tvam. Savadeva Mayeshwaram. Ye pyanya devata bhakta. Yad yap yanya diyak prabho. But all these people, my Lord, even those who have turned their attention away from you and are worshipping other deities, are actually worshipping you alone, O embodiment of all the demigods. Purport. The idea here is that even those who worship the demigods are indirectly worshipping the Supreme Lord Vishnu. The understanding of such worshippers, however, is imperfect. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilatam Mena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So those of you who are familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, I assume most of you are, could not fail to call to mind a verse there, which I am now going to share with you. In the ninth chapter, text 23, Krishna says something practically identical. He says there, after the verse, ananyaschintayanto mam yejana payupasate, tesha nityabhyaktanam yogakshema mahamiham. There he's, after describing how futile it is to worship the demigods for elevation to the higher planets, because even if you succeed, and there he says something very interesting, just like Akura does, those who worship me by drinking the soma juice trying to go to the heavenly planets and following the prescriptions in the Vedas that describe demigod worship, they may go to the heavenly planets. Tetam bukva swagalogam vishalam, and there enjoy vast amounts of godly delights. But chine punne matyalokam vishanti. After the pious credit, just like credit in the bank, you know, you deposit so much money in the bank and you have your credit card and it works and works and works and works, and then at a certain point it spits it back and they say, sorry, Mr. Smith, this card won't work. And then if you don't have any money, you have to go back to work. So back to work means coming back to this Martyaloka, in this case, Martyaloka Vishanti, that when your pious credit is finished, you have to come back to this world of birth and death. And therefore, Krishna says, Evam tahi dhamma manupapannagatakatam kama kama labam. For those who simply want to fulfill material desires by worshipping the gods or anything else, you just come and go. It's frustrating. You don't end up really making any progress back to God. And so in the next verse, Krishna gives the contrast. Ananyaschintayanto mam yedinapayupasate tesham nityabhyuktanam yogakshem vahamyam. But on the other hand, those who always worship me directly with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. So this yogakshema, this is a standard Sanskrit idiom, which means yoga, the things that you need to live, and kshema, your security, your safety, your situation. So Krishna says, I personally carry that for my pure devotees. And then in the next verse, he very much echoes Akura's prayer. Ye pyanya devata bhakta yajante shadayanvita tepi mame vakonte yajant avadipurvakam. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti, but they do so in a wrong way. So this of course, is based on the understanding that all these gods, whether it's Shiva or Brahma or subordinate gods or Durga, they all get their powers from Krishna. Everything is coming from Krishna. So whatever you can get from them, you can get directly from Krishna. So since the purport was kind of short, I'm going to read this short purport that Prabhupada gives to this verse, which expands on this idea. Now, Prabhupada begins the purport by quoting Krishna. Persons who are engaged in worship of demigods are not very intelligent. That's mentioned in the seventh chapter, Upamedasam, not much brain substance, Prabhupada. They're not very intelligent, although such worship is offered to me indirectly, Krishna says. For example, when a man pours water on the leaves and branches of a tree without pouring water on the root, he does so without sufficient knowledge or without observing regulative principles. Similarly, the process of rendering service to different parts of the body is to supply food to the stomach. The demigods are, so to speak, different officers and directors in the government of the Supreme Lord. One has to follow the laws made by the government, not by the officers or the directors. Similarly, everyone is to offer his worship to the Supreme Lord only. That will automatically satisfy the different officers and directors of the Lord. The officers and directors are engaged as representatives of the government, and to offer some bribe to the officers and directors is illegal. This is stated here as avidipurvakam. Avidipurvakam means not according to vidhi, or the actual instructions of the Vedas. It's a mistaken idea. In other words, Krishna does not approve the unnecessary worship of the demigods. So this is the statement of Akura. He's dealing with this after having explained. He says there are others. Well, who did he describe before? That was in the previous class. Those who are pure Vaishnavas. What is it? In the pursuit of knowledge. Oh, no. It's in text 6 he was describing. Yes. No. Where is it? I'm sorry. I'm losing my track here. Anyway, he's describing the pure devotees, and then there's these others, and it's the same thing that we find in the Bhagavad Gita. By contrast, Krishna is illustrating the importance of worshipping him exclusively, which of course culminates in his famous instruction, Sarvatarma Buddhitya Mamikam Sharanamraja. So now, but how does Shiva worship? Those who worship Shiva for material benefits, we find they're often demons. Ravana was a great worshipper of Shiva, wasn't he? Was Jarasandha also, or was he worshipping Kali? I think he also worshipped both. And oftentimes, and who was that famous demon who was cutting? Vrikasura. He's cutting off parts of his body, horrifically, and offering into the fire, worshipping of Shiva, Lord Shiva. And what happened? Ultimately, out of his compassion, he's about to cut off his head and offer it into the fire. Just see how ghastly this form of worship is. And then, so Shiva, out of compassion, he appears out of the fire and offers him a benediction. What is the benediction he chose right there? Yeah. I mean, this is like mode of ignorance, you know, personified. So Shiva says, okay. And then he wants to try it on Shiva. Where's the devotion? Where's the bhakti? You understand? So, you know, eventually, the last time he was tricked. You know, Shiva's running now because he knows that this benediction is going to work. So Vrikasura is running after Shiva all the way up to Vaikuntha. And Vrikasura, he's tired. He's breathing hard by all the running. And Krishna, he disguises himself as a Brahmin boy or something. And says, oh, take it easy, take it easy. You know, the body is so important. You know, rest a little bit. And he wants to know what are you doing? He said, well, I'm chasing Shiva. He's trying to cheat me. Or, you know, he gave me this benediction. He said, oh, Shiva? You know, his benediction is useless, you know. He's cheated you. And Krishna, one of his qualities, he's so skillful at speaking, he can convince anybody of anything. Bhava dukkha. You know? He said, look, if you doubt my words, just try it. Try it. Touch your head. You'll see it doesn't work. You know? And
really?
And he touches his head and boom, it cracks open and finished. So this is, but just see who is worshipping Lord Shiva. So, but that doesn't mean that Shiva himself is not a Vaishnava. Shiva he allows the Buddhas and the Pretas and the ghosts and the demons to worship him, so that at least they'll be connected in that way. They get some kind of auspiciousness. Shiva himself, the word Shiva means auspicious. But who does Shiva worship? Now for that, we have a wonderful section of the Bhagavatam called Singing the Song of Lord Shiva in the fourth canto. And I'd like to share one verse with you that he chants in the midst of that prayer near the end of it. He's teaching this to the Prachetas, who are then going to chant this prayer while staying under the water for 10,000 years, so that they become qualified to then propagate. They're meant to be Prajapatis. But before that, they learn this prayer, singing the song of Lord Shiva. So within this prayer, there's a wonderful direct prayer of Shiva to Krishna, and he's praying to the lotus feet. So this is the mood of Lord Shiva, who's known as the best Vaishnava, Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu. So Lord Shiva prays, Padasharat Padma Palasha Rochisha Nakadubir Non Tamagan Vadunvata Padasha Svi Mapasta Sabdasham Padam Godo Marga Kadusta Modusham. My dear Lord, your two lotus feet are so beautiful that they appear like two blossoming petals of the lotus flower that grows during the autumn season. Indeed, the nails of your lotus feet emanate such a great effulgence that they immediately dissipate all the darkness in the heart of the conditioned soul. My dear Lord, kindly show me that form of yours which always dissipates all kinds of darkness in the heart of a devotee. My dear Lord, you are the supreme spiritual master of everyone. Therefore, all conditioned souls covered with the darkness of ignorance can be enlightened by you as a spiritual master. It's a beautiful verse. And we also know that when Lord Chaitanya went to South India, of course he's delivering everybody, propagating Sankirtan, but he also worshipped in many Shiva temples. And the prayers that he sang there are recorded by Murari Gupta in his book, the Chaitanya Charita, I think it is. And I don't know any of them by heart, I don't know them here, but the gist of these prayers is that he's praising him as a great Vaishnava, and he's praying for, please bless me with devotion to Govinda. Lord Chaitanya's teaching how one should pray to Lord Shiva for the greatest gift, not anything material, but for bhakti, yoga. So this idea of worship, now let's shift gears just a little bit and go to the seventh chapter, another section where Krishna demeans, or he dismisses, if you will, the worship of the demigods. After describing how one is really in knowledge, bahunam dharmanamante gyanabhanam papadyate, one who really is in knowledge after many, many births surrenders unto me. But then he says, kamaistaisa ritajnana papadyate anya devata, those whose intelligence is stolen away by material desires, ritajnana, they worship other gods than me. Controlled by their own natures, they follow certain rules and regulations for that worship. And then he says, yo yo yam yam tanu bhakta shadayachna mittiti tisita sachalam shadham tam adavadhanyam. Whatever you want to worship. And now you broaden this. You know, what is the essential quality of this idea of worship? This is kind of something that human beings always go to, whether they're in the Vedic culture or not. You know? Today, you know, it's right in the Bible. I'm talking about the Bible now. We meditate on Ecclesiastes. But doesn't it say about, you have to worship either God or mammon, right? Isn't there a God of wealth, right? Kind of a God. And people worship that in today's society. What does the worship mean? First of all, they're meditating a lot on it, right? They're seeing that wealth as the provider of yoga kshema, of all security and all necessities and all pleasures and everything. And like it work like anything. They study, they go to gurus, you know, maybe going on the internet, how can you invest, how can you do this, how can I make more money? Even the education. You know, when we were in school, I mean, I remember when I went to school, there was a large percentage of the devotees, they're devotees, but who were into the humanities. Remember that? I mean, it wasn't like the humanities, what are you going to do with that degree in literature and art, you know? In other words, that was a valid pursuit. But now practically the whole education, even from high school and below, is geared toward how can you get a job? How can you be trained to do something that's marketable in society? Right? So that means you're worshiping mammon. You're worshiping, you know. And the scientists, they worship the material energy. You're investigating it. You're looking at it. You're trying to learn, right? So many things. You're going to those who know more, and it's a kind of, you know, go to a guru, chemistry guru, whatever. Guru means teacher, ultimately. Why? So we can manipulate this material energy. So we can get more oil. Or we think that the gas is finished. We can frack the shale and we can get so much gas, you know, natural gas. And that way we'll be more powerful and so forth. This is a form of worship. So Krishna says in this, yo-yo yangam tunum bhakta shodayachita mishrati. Whatever form you want to worship with faith, I'll make that faith strong. I'll make the faith strong. And then he says, and with that faith, you will worship that god or gods that you worship, and you'll get some result. But whatever result you get, you should know it's actually coming from me. That's the problem. People don't know that. They forget completely where all of the benedictions are coming from. And they simply think that it's coming from our powerful worship, whatever form it may take. So then Krishna says, this is the conclusion. Antavattu palantesham tadbhavaltyopamedesham. But these gifts, these results of this worship, are all temporary and insignificant. These palantesham. And only desired by the opamedesha, those who are fools, not very smart. And then he has a line that's practically identical to a verse you'll recognize in the ninth chapter. Devan devijyo yanti madbhakta yanti mamati. Those who worship the gods go to the gods, but those who worship me come to me. So now we're back to the idea of that what absorbs your mind, what absorbs your heart and your energy, that's where your consciousness is going to be. And that's going to be determining your next birth. So these scientists, they're worshiping a wide, you know, vast amount of money, vast amount of science is spent. We don't even know. It's secret in researching new weapons, new ways in which you can, and not just, you know, weapons like shoot a bullet or shoot a missile or something. Cyber weapons, little tiny drone insects, you know, that'll come around and surveil, you know, all kinds of things. This is all part of the, you know, misuse of obviously, of intelligence and a form of worship. What kind of consciousness is that? It's the most demoniac, you know, low, tamasic consciousness you can imagine. And yet that is, you know, what people are absorbing their minds in. So this whole movement is meant for redirecting the human energy, beginning with what people are worshiping in the broader sense. And how to do that? Through every means. Through, most obviously, your intelligence. Intelligence is key. That's our difference between us and the animals. Understanding that worshiping anything else, absorbing the mind in anything else, but Krishna, but God, and reestablishing our relationship, will lead to so much suffering. Well, how to come to that conclusion? Oh, you're not the body, Prabhu. You know, the spirit, consciousness is supreme. If you allow your consciousness to get absorbed in these lower modes of nature, then you will suffer greatly. So the whole science of bhakti is meant to attract us away from these frustrating objects to try to interact with and worship and aspire for, which leads us astray. These are called the riddhi agranti, the knots in the heart. They're subtle, but they tie us to the gross world, you know. And some of them are you know, ideas. My friend Pushkar, he always likes to remind me of shlokas that I've forgotten. And so he called my attention to one, I think it's in the sixth canto. Yachakteyo vaninam varinam vai. I forget the whole verse, but it means that, oh Krishna, your energy, by your energy, you inspire in different philosophers and different people with their ideas and their philosophies, so that there's an endless variety of wrong philosophies in this world. And spoken by very eloquent speakers, and books are written, you know. Anything a way that obscure the true philosophy, the actual Bhagavad Dharma, you know. That energy to even think of these things is coming from Krishna. But they don't know that, because the philosophy obscures that, their material desires obscure it. So the Bhagavatam, these prayers of Akura, Akura is, of course, known for his prayers, and in a few verses, we're going to get to, you know, these the conclusion of these prayers in the river, right? These are the prayers, isn't he standing in Yamuna now, and he's praying to a manifestation of Krishna and Balaram, and that's what we're reading now. So he gets to the point at near the end of his prayers where he's describing how every living entity is wandering in this world, impelled by their own karma, by their material desires. Aham mameti asagraho, he describes. Aham mameti asagraho, which means covered by this essential element of false ego, I am the body and the things in relation to the body of mind. And asagraha, based on that misconception, so many false philosophies. Agraha is a way of grasping the world, of understanding the world. You know, so that's and brahmate karma bhavnasu, and with these false philosophies and impelled by this false sense of self and desire, they wander in different bodies and different planets. Brahmate karma bhavnasu. And then he says, but I'm also like that. He takes the role of a conditioned soul. Hum chatnat majagaro. I'm also identifying with my body and my wife and children and my home, and in this way, swapna diya. I'm thinking that this dreamlike existence is real, and this is it. And therefore, my whole conception is reversed. Everything is upside down. Anityanatma dukkeshu viparhiya matiryaham vanvaram astamo vishto najani tvatma kriya. Very nice verse. You're going to read about it. I'll be gone by then, but in a week or two or so. So what does he say there? Anitya anatma dukeshu means that which is not eternal, I'm thinking to be eternal. You know, my situation in this material world. The most amazing thing, that we act and we live as if this situation is permanent. So anitya anatma, that which I am not, this body and its expansions, I'm thinking is me. And dukeshu, those which are sources of misery, I'm thinking to be sources of pleasure. Right? Yehi sangs bharjaja bhoga dukayone. That the bhoga, the pleasure that comes from sparshaja, is born of the touch or the contact of the senses with the sense objects, is the very source of our misery. Krishna certifies, fifth chapter. But I'm thinking this is you know where my pleasure is. This food, this person, this you know, idea, whatever. Millions and millions of things that I could become attracted to. So, what in this state? Nityanaba vipari material, dvanva ramos, I'm trying to enjoy these dualities, tamo vishto, and entering more and more into darkness and ignorance. And the greatest tragedy, najani tvatma priyam. I've forgotten that you, my Lord, are my dearmost master and friend. Completely forgotten you. And then he compares it, it's a very nice analogy. Yatabodo jalam hitva padichandam tadudhavai. Imagine you're in a desert, but you're in the oasis in the desert, a small oasis, like an acre, you know. And you're standing at the edge, you're very thirsty, and right next to your foot is a nice cool pool of water, but it's overgrown with leaves and grasses and things, you can't see it. And so you're looking out into the desert and you see a mirage and you run after it. It's called abhuta, someone who's unintelligent. So this is what he says. I've turned my face away from you, just like this person who's running out in the desert. In other words, we have the ocean of bliss in our hearts, every one of us. This is our birthright. This is who we really are. But we're going outside, bahirata manina, you know, looking outside for our pleasure, security, yoga, kshema, and everything else. You know, forgetting the reservoir of pleasure within our hearts. And so, then he laments, Akur is lamenting. He says, how does it go? I forget the Sanskrit, but he says, oh, my dear Lord, I don't have the strength to control my mind. Even though I know this, theoretically, you just give us the philosophy. He said, but I don't have the strength to control my mind and sense. My senses are pulling me here and there. You know, now what to do? So the last verse, or near the last verse, he says, but even in this case, I'm throwing myself at your lotus feet. You see? Because even, I don't know, by your mercy, even if someone is unqualified, you know, and is uncontrolled, by your mercy, you can still give him your lotus feet and give him the strength to control his self and come to you. By the mercy of the guru, he mentions the spiritual master in that verse. Very instructive. So this is how he will conclude this series of prayers on that note. And very instructive. That's Akura is the acharya for prayers. We can learn so much here. But again, focusing on the one we're studying today, he's describing the phenomenon of how this worship instinct, if you will, of human beings is misdirected. And life after life, if we don't contact someone in knowledge who can really intervene. I like to give this idea of an intervention. You know, someone is addicted to some drug or whatever, you know, or alcohol, you know, drug. Then sometimes it becomes impossible on their own. They can't do anything. You know, again and again they try, again and again they fall away. So they need an intervention from a friend or relative or somebody who's ready to shake them up and drag them to AA or whatever, right? Please help me. Okay, I surrender, you know. So it's just like that. We've been addicted to these varieties of sensual edifications and varieties of false philosophies and misworshiped, you know, for millions of lifetimes. And many of those lifetimes we have no chance. We're just in the animal kingdom. But even as human beings, you know, we have no chance without the intervention of the acharya, the guru, or Krishna himself. Isn't that why he comes? He comes because there's so much confusion. The demons have become ascendant. You know, they're misguiding everybody. Isn't it? I think that's why Krishna came. And during the Advaita Acharya saw, you know, that even though there's Vaishnavas, you know, that there's too many demons, too much confusion in Navadvipa, and he prayed that Lord Chaitanya would come, that Krishna would come personally, and he came as Lord Chaitanya. So that intervention happens in these, you know, huge ways that Krishna comes down, Lord Chaitanya comes down, and also personally for each of us. Somebody has to enter into this bubble of confusion that we've created for ourselves and that we're living in. And that's the devotee. The pure devotee, of course, does this in spades, you know. But every one of us has had an experience of a representative of Krishna, representative of the pure devotee, entering into us, giving us a book, inviting us, giving us a smile, somehow or other, a mantra card, inviting us to the temple, somehow giving us a clue that to come into a different kind of atmosphere. And if we're fortunate enough to embrace that, to be receptive to the message, and receptive to the holy name, and then we have a chance of being reformed and redirecting our worship away from matter and the wrong personalities to Krishna, who can actually help us. And as he says, yoga kshema bahamyaham. And I'll one other pertinent verse in this regard comes at the beginning of the second canto. You remember there's a certain point where Sukadeva Goswami is giving a whole, how can I say, you know, it's not polite, a kind of a shopping list, you know, of gods and goddesses that you can worship. If you want a powerful body, you worship Indra. You know, if you want knowledge, you worship Sarva. If you want health, you worship Surya. Surya Namaskar, whatever. And he goes through, and he mentions Shiva twice there. He says, if you want heroism, then you worship the Rudra expansions of Shiva. And if you want a lot of knowledge and become a Muni, you worship Shiva directly. But then he says, akama sarva kamova, moksha kama udara di. Tivrena Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purusham Param. That whether if you happen to be free of all material desires, in other words, you're already very advanced, or you're full of all kinds of material desires, or you want liberation, moksha kama, and notice that all of these are different kinds of kamas, they're different kinds of material. Even desire for liberation for oneself is a material desire. But if you're intelligent, udara di, broad-minded and understanding, then you'll render intense bhakti yoga and pure divine bhakti to the Supreme Person. And then all of your desires will be fulfilled. Well, what happens there, as many of us have experienced, is that those other desires, they kind of fade away. If you don't feed them, if you don't meditate on them and engage in trying to fulfill them, then the desire for Krishna bhakti, for things in relation to Krishna, takes over, and the others naturally fall away. Param drishvana vartate, vishayamvini vartate. So that's the only way that we can actually become free from the thrall of these different attractions to worship money, you know, worship power, worship this, worship that, and become completely confused. So it's a question of directing. Of course, it's a yoga process. How much can we have this one-pointed worship of Krishna and the service of Krishna? That is our struggle. That's our sadhana, so that we don't become diverted. And that will give us the greatest benefit. Okay, so I'll end there now. Maybe let me read these two translations again. There are still others who worship you, the Supreme Lord, in the form of Lord Shiva. They follow the path described by him and interpreted in various ways by many teachers. But all these people, my Lord, even those who have turned their attention away from you and are worshipping other deities, are actually worshipping you alone, O embodiment of all the demigods. Any questions or comments on these points? Oh, I'm sorry, Shesha. I didn't see you.
Dhruvaprabhu, I take it that, you know, we talk about worship, of how the materialist worshiping money and things like that, you're not speaking allegorically, but actually saying that the activity, the inclination of the human being is misdirected in that way, and that's the same worship that would be, same mentality, same activity that would be used in worshiping God.
It's distorted, but I mean, the same. If you study it, you can see that the same elements are there. You know, what is worship? I mean, obviously, the first thing is it means it pays attention, and you glorify, and you desire some result from that worship. So think about that. Especially whenever, you know, the political season comes, and nowadays it's practically all the time, right? So what are they doing, you know, these politicians? They're trying to draw your worship. They want tribute. You have to, you know, give some donation so they can pay for the campaign. They glorification. And, of course, you're looking for, in general, hope and change, right? Because no one is ever satisfied in the present condition. So they're hoping that this person, you know, will change things because of the upcoming. It's just like worship, you know. Worship a demigod. So now when it becomes a little more impersonal, when I say they worship mammon, you know, or money, well, that has the elements of certainly paying attention. And the idea that this object or this entity will provide my needs, will give me what I need, right? So that's the main idea. You know, wherever you put your attention, whatever you strive for, that's a form of worship. We are, of course, when it becomes very personal, you know, then you worship a politician, you worship a demigod, in that way, or you worship Krishna, then the elements of glorification and prayer and surrender, right? You surrender your time and your energy is obvious. And what are we praying for? We also have prayers, you know? But ideally, you know, we're taught not to pray for anything material to the Supreme Person. to pray for the most valuable thing, you know, love for you, right? Nadanang, nadanang, nasundari, kavitamba. So the training is that this particular verse gives up or directly negates that which materialists worship, you know, or what their object of worship. They may worship the demigods to get the money, you know, but others are just worshiping the money, the misers, you know. They may not have any regard for God at all, but they worship the money, you know. They gather the money. Like I said, there's a nice prayer like that, how we can redirect. Forgive me, I can't end without one poem. So this is from the Padyavali. This is from Vichayani, Vichayani, Vichinchani, Punapuna, Kripanasya Dhanani, Vatvam Namani, Bhavantunaha. Compelled to constantly collect and count his precious hoard, the miser contemplates his wealth with avaricious aims. Please bless me to become a miser who's compelled, O Lord, to constantly collect and count and contemplate your names. Okay. So it's just the object of worship that has to be changed. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada. He went, Trivikrama had something.
Hare Krishna. Yesterday, Srila Prabhupada was speaking about the Vedas and the supplements. Well, for example, the Puranas in the mode of ignorance, or, you know, I don't know if that's the best description, but they propagate that, you know, they propagate that actually Lord Shiva is the supreme, you know, in those. And so, for less intelligent people, that would be heart and soul. They would take that, you know. And so, that could be very confusing.
Yeah, it could be, if we didn't have the direction from Bhagavatam and the Acharyas. So, the understanding is, well, these are people in the mode of, you know, ignorance, going to worship, right? They're not going to immediately become free of their material desires, and, you know, they're not ready to receive the ultimate message. So therefore, it's good that they worship Shiva, you know. Otherwise, what, you know, they're going to go off. So Shiva is good to worship. And at one point, if they're focused on Lord Shiva, perhaps they can get, you know, the actual teaching of Lord Shiva, like I was reading from the Bhagavatam, you know, or meet a Shiva worshiper who's intelligent and is worshiping Shiva as Lord Chaitanya taught. Why did he go to the Shiva temples, you know, to teach the Shaivites how to, you know, what to really pray for? I mean, that's the key, you know. You can go to Krishna and also pray, you know, for anything. You know, let me get the, you know, money, let me get the weapons to beat my enemy, you know. But that's all, that's worship in the mode of ignorance, even if you worship Krishna. It's not worship according to what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. So these other Puranas, at least keep these people into the Vedic culture, you know. Better they worship the gods, that they worship nothing, or that they become impersonalist, you know. Because it maintains the idea of worshiping a higher authority. And then if you happen to read the Bhagavad Purana, you'll find that Indra, you know, that he ultimately comes to the point of worshiping Krishna in the Govardhan Leela, right, and glorifying him properly. So that's the understanding. But, you know, this was the strategy of Veda Vyas, is that to give something for everybody in all of these other Puranas and other things. But ultimately, it becomes very confusing, and in this Kali Yuga, it's misused. It's completely misused. You know, this worship of Kali, and you know, the idea of we want to eat meat, so we'll offer the goat to Kali, you know. And that's all it is. You know, they're not elevating beyond that. So to cut through all of the confusion and the thicket, you know, Lord Chaitanya came and just gave a complete, you know, conclusion of everything, you know. And chant the holy name, Bhagavad Gita, the pure devotion. And everything else falls into place, all the God worship and everything, you know. And we should remember, you know, that this is an offense against the holy name. We're taught right away. You chant Hare Krishna, but then if you want to achieve success in the chanting, you have to avoid the 10 offenses, right? And one of the second offense, to think that the names of the demigods are equal to or independent of the name of Lord Vishnu. Actually, that brings up one other point, if you allow me. That second offense, there's actually three parts to it. The idea is that equal and independent of, you know, that's actually two different things. So what? How does it go? Shivasya, Shri Namna. That's the beginning of it. So Shivasya can be the name of Shiva or can simply be the auspicious name. But then the key word is binadiyam. You see? Diyabhinam. So diyabhinam could be divided as diyabhinam or diyabhinam. You know how sometimes the Sanskrit has these two different meanings, like niyamagraha, right? So diyabhinam, you have the mentality, the idea that there is a separation between the name of Shiva and the name of Krishna. In other words, the idea is that you shouldn't think that, all right, I'll worship Krishna, I'll chant the name of Krishna to get one benediction, but I want to cover my bases, so I better chant the name of Shiva to get the others. You know, sometimes you see a Hindu temple, they have all the gods and goddesses, and there's Lakshmi Narayan, isn't it? I've seen temples like that. So that's an offense against the holy name. You know, and to think that there's no difference. In other words, that, yeah, you can chant the name of Shiva, you can chant the name of Krishna, you get the same benefit. You see the distinction between that, those two? One is I have to cover all bases. I chant Shiva's name, I chant Durga's name, I chant Vidhana's name, Chandri, and also Krishna's name. That's diyabhinam. But to think that there's no difference, and you can chant any name you want, that's another offense. But here's the offense that we don't chant. It's in the purport there in the Adi Leela, in describing this. And it's very important understanding to think that the auspicious name of Vishnu is different from Vishnu. There's a separation between Vishnu and his name. That's an offense. So we should remember when we chant Hare Krishna, you know, that Krishna is there. That Krishna is there in the sound. And that we're actually able to associate with Krishna through that sound by chanting his name. Pran, and we'll end with that, your discourse. Hare Bol. Glorious to Prabhupada. Yes, very interesting. Thank you very much for that. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.